The mic is on. Okay, I think we'll start by opening up a work session on Senate Bill 117. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 117, you had a hearing on this bill on April 5th. It would reinstate Oregon's no-call program that regulates unlawful telephone solicitations and expand it to include wireless telephone numbers. It allows for the designation of the National Do Not Call Registry instead of operating a separate state registry, and it maintains the investigation, enforcement, and civil penalty authority under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act that were in place prior to federal preemption of Oregon's law.
Okay. I'd like Mr. Shepherd and Mr. Cosgrove to come forward, please, since Mr. Cosgrove had some questions about it, and we didn't have the opportunity to have Mr. Shepherd be able to reply to it. So, welcome, Mr. Shepherd. If you could review for the committee again, you know, purposes for Senate Bill 117 and what we're trying to achieve. I know the members realize that we are using the federal no call, but there are requirements for the state no call to have conformity. And if you could give us that background, then we'll hear from Mr. Cosgrove and have a discussion on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'll get right to the point. There are 1.6 million Oregonians who've said that they don't want to receive unsolicited calls. That's the number of Oregonians on the federal Do Not Call list at the moment. In 1999, this assembly, on the urging of Attorney General Hardy Myers, adopted the state no-call program. It was, at the time, one of the first in the nation. I think there were two or three other states that had done it, and we modeled it on one of those, a couple of those other states. It was constitutional. It was effective. It was cost-free to taxpayers. It was locally accountable, and it was aggressively enforced. Since 2002, when the federal government adopted its national no-call program and required state laws to comply with certain elements of that federal law, there has been effectively no enforcement of the no-call system. The Oregon system that had previously been so effective has been preempted by the federal law. And the bottom line is that since that act of preemption occurred in 2002, the no-call law has no teeth. And Senate Bill 117 is the mechanism by which you can restore the status quo ante and return us to a situation in which we have effective tools to address a real problem for our clients.
Yeah. Mr. Shepherd, what could you give us maybe just a background in terms of the type of, because I think this probably relates to our other bill, too, 863. So just what kind of activity do you have in terms of complaints by consumers about the no-call list and the nature of those?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me give you very, very briefly a short description of the basic operation of our Consumer Protection Unit to give you some context for how we use the discretionary enforcement tools that we have. First, specifically to your question, our understanding is that in 2006 there were approximately 15,000 complaints about violation of the no-call from Oregonians. So that's the magnitude of Oregonians' reports of violations of their desire not to be contacted with unsolicited calls. When we had an effective enforcement tool for the Oregon no-call statute, we enforced it the way we do all the other consumer protection, unlawful trade practice enforcement responsibilities to which we've been assigned by this assembly. And the first layer is consumers who send us complaints, whether they're by email or in regular mail. We open a file on that, and the initial response typically is by a consumer enforcement officer, not a lawyer, not an investigator. The consumer enforcement officer sends a letter to the business or the alleged violator and says, we received a complaint from a consumer about you. Here's what the consumer had to say. Typically, we include a copy of that. We want you to give you a chance to address the consumer's concerns, rectify them if there's merit to them, explain it if there isn't any merit to them, and if we get a satisfactory answer at that point, we don't do anything further. If that complaint matches up with a pattern of complaints by that same individual, then typically we look at that pattern of complaints and see whether it suggests to us that these violations are willful violations of law. If they are willful violations of the law, then we look at the range of potential resolutions, potential tools that we have, and the first tool we have is to apply our investigative resources to that, which is provided for in Senate Bill 117, but not in any of the other mechanisms which you might have available to you to give us effective enforcement of the no-call law. Those investigative tools include the requirement that the business or the person complained of give us information about the nature of the complaint. And so we typically would inquire of the business, give us your explanation, and if we can't get the records we need just voluntarily, then we have the authority to demand those of the business. And then we look at it and we say, how egregious is this violation? Was the business on notice? Did it know that it was violating the law? And did it have adequate notice of how to comply with the law? If it did, if it knew it had that it was on notice of what the law required, often because there had previously been a complaint about the same conduct, then we're likely to take a harsher view of that and seek a more significant penalty. Under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in Oregon, unlike many other states, our first option is not to file a lawsuit alleging that a violation of law occurred. Instead, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is the enforcement mechanism for Senate Bill 117, requires us first to tender to the business an assurance of voluntary compliance. And the statute provides that an assurance of voluntary compliance, if entered into by that business, is not an admission of a violation of law. So unlike many other states, it's not necessary for the Attorney General to accuse the business in a court pleading of violating the law. Instead, we tender an assurance of voluntary compliance. Now, typically, one of the goals we have for that, and that we had when we were enforcing the no-call law, was to transfer the costs of that enforcement action from taxpayers, from public resources, onto the entity that violated the law. And we were successful in doing that. The previous enforcement of the Oregon no-call law was completely cost-free to taxpayers, in part because one of our goals was to transfer those costs to the violator. So I hope that answers your question, Senator Metzger. That's the basic way in which we approach consumer protection issues of all stripes and how it fits in with Senate Bill 117.
Okay. Before I go to any questions, I'm going to go to Mr. Cosgrove and tell me if you what concerns, if any, you had, and we'll have that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, and I and others who have worked on this law over the years share the exact same goal with the Attorney General, an adequately enforced with appropriate remedies and procedures no-call list. It's just we feel there's a different and, frankly, simpler way to get there, and that is the one that was adopted by this body last session in Senate Bill 208A engrossed. And what that provided was that as it is the case under federal law, the Attorney General under federal law is expressly authorized to enforce the federal law. The Attorney General, when we were discussing 208 last session, felt that that wasn't sufficient in that it would have to enforce that law in federal court. So in 208A, we said you can enforce it in state court. And then there were discussions about we need these other remedies of assurance of voluntary compliance and to be able to collect fines and penalties that wouldn't go to the federal government but would, in fact, go to the Attorney General's office. And we agreed to those changes as well. That is a methodology that we think is simpler, cleaner, eliminates the possibility of duplicate enforcement by a federal agency and a state agency for the same violation, and provides the Attorney General with all of those tools that Mr. Shepherd just mentioned to you. So that would be our solution to the problem. We agree with the goal. We just have a different method of getting there.
Thank you. Mr. Shepherd, you want to reply to Mr. Cosgrove's concerns?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, respectfully, we do disagree with Mr. Cosgrove. First of all, Senate Bill 208A does not provide for civil penalties for each violation of the law. The proposal only allows for follow the law or cease and desist injunctions. So if we were to detect a willful violation of Oregon's no-call law, perhaps a magnificently willful violation of Oregon's no-call law, regardless of the level of proof of the willfulness of the violator, we would not have the capacity under 208A, as we understand its provisions, to seek or to compel the payment of a penalty. And after all, what we're engaged in here is a law enforcement function. When you get to the bottom of this, you have established in law a standard of conduct for people in the marketplace, and it may come to the necessity of deterring, both by specific deterrence, punishment, if you will, of an individual violator, or general deterrence, making an example, if you will, of an individual violator, in order to get the point across that we're serious about enforcing the statute. And as we understand 208A, it does not permit us to seek civil penalties that would make that specific deterrent and general deterrent point. And secondly, as we understand Senate Bill 208A, it lacks the investigative tools that I described that are available under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And because it does so, frankly, I'm surprised that folks would be advocates for it, because it's those investigative tools that allow us to sort the wheat from the chaff in the investigative stage and ascertain whether the allegations are sustainable, whether in fact what the consumer has said to us about the violator reflects a willful violation or a mistaken error. And so it has puzzled us considerably that that folks who would not be advocates as well for the same kind of flexible and effective investigative tools that we have under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And as to the complexity or simplicity, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act has been around since the early 1970s, and we have quite a lengthy history of experience with how it operates. It's been tested in litigation. We understand its terms. Specifically, as to its utility in the no-call scheme, we think we demonstrated that it was effective when we had authority to enforce it. So we simply and respectfully disagree with the proposition that there's any simpler alternative than making this part of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Okay. Questions from the committee for either of these gentlemen? Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I think last time we had a hearing, I think we discussed with the department if you could meet with those interested parties and try to come up with some kind of compromise. And it seems like we're exactly where we were last time we left. Why couldn't we somehow try to work with Mr. Cosgrove? What happened there, and did you guys meet, and what was the result of that meeting?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, at the last meeting, following the last meeting, Mr. Scholl from the Department of Justice said he would go back and discuss whether 208A or some derivation or improvement on 208A would be satisfactory. There was no meeting. There was just an announcement that would not be satisfactory, and that came relatively late in the process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Senator George, I appreciate the concern and the desire to have parties resolve such matters. Mr. Cosgrove and I are not old, are not new adversaries on this issue. This is the very same debate that was held last session. We have, in fact, looked carefully to see if we can understand how it is that Senate Bill 208 in any form is superior to Senate Bill 117. And we can't find, the Attorney General cannot identify any reason why Senate Bill 208A would be superior policy option to Senate Bill 117. To be very straightforward with the committee, we just don't think there's anything new to say between the parties. We really, in our judgment, we're at the point where we need the Legislative Assembly to make a policy choice.
Other questions?
I do.
Senator Stark.
For Mr. Shepard. Does the department require a consumer complaint before it undergoes some sort of investigation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act does not require it. It is not a requirement of law. As a practical matter, we won't be aware of, in the usual case, of a complaint, of a concern about a violation of law in the absence of a consumer complaint. There are some areas where we are so routinely engaged in a particular sector of a marketplace where we do become occasionally on our own aware of an issue. For example, there are some kinds of advertising issues that an employee of the financial fraud section where we do our unlawful trade practice enforcement might observe an advertisement that he or she perceives as a potential violation of law and bring that to the attention of the investigators and the lawyers there. But even in those cases, again, the initiation would not be immediately all guns blazing. It would be an inquiry of the advertiser or the business to ascertain what the level of knowledge of the advertiser or business was about what seems on the face of it to be a violation of law.
What about follow-up, Mr. Chair? As the agency proceeds to investigate violations of the Trade Practices Act, does the do you look at what other states have done in the event that there's a business that has operations in multiple states?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we often are engaged through the National Association of Attorneys General and various cooperative working groups that are formed there with multi-state enforcement actions in which many attorneys general or other consumer protection agencies collaborate with a unified, the same approach, singular approach to a business that's doing business on a national scale. Specifically, so in those cases, there wouldn't be a question of differential enforcement policy as between Oregon and some other state because we'd be part of a multi-state group addressing the same conduct and typically resolving it in a singular resolution that would have the same kind of requirements across many states. There are instances in which we are pursuing enforcement action independently from some parallel enforcement action in another state. And in those cases, the resolution here might be different than the resolution reached in another state, simply because a different attorney general accountable to a different electorate might well reach a different judgment about the magnitude of the violation in respect to Oregonians, or a different judgment about the significance of the particular violation to Oregonians individually. We would, of course, be interested in the question of what other states have done, because one of the things we try to do is avoid any disproportionate use of our enforcement resources. But we certainly wouldn't be bound by it, and I wouldn't suggest to you and wouldn't want you to think that we would consider ourselves limited by what other states have done.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that the Attorney General can go out and prosecute a Oregon business without having one consumer complaint whatsoever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that's not prohibited by law. And it would be permissible to do so. And let me suggest, I think the hypothetical, and it really I think is for the most part a hypothetical, but what it suggests is a judgment that would be an inappropriate use of the Attorney General's discretionary authority to prosecute. And I take that point, and I concede that it could be. But I also think that we have to acknowledge that there are circumstances in which that would not be an inappropriate use of the Attorney General's discretionary authority, and let me tell you why. The basic premise of advertising restrictions or limitations that go to, for example, false or misleading advertisements, the basic idea behind the state's role in that part of our marketplace is that consumers need the best information, accurate information they can to allow the marketplace to operate properly. The price at which the sale of goods and services are established in a free market depends on the free flow of information. If the information is false, is misleadingly presented, consumers may never know that they have been the victim of an unlawful trade practice violation. And in that kind of circumstance, I would suggest to you that an attorney general who didn't take enforcement action would have abused his or her
final,
enforcement
final question,
authority.
Mr. Chair. Yes. The civil penalties that the attorney general levies, where do those ultimately end up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the statutes provide that the civil penalties are paid into what's called the Consumer Protection and Education Revolving Account, which is the mechanism by which the Assembly has chosen over the years to be the exclusive funding mechanism for all consumer protection activities in Oregon. And that is a very big challenge for us, members of the committee. We have counseled against that over the years because it creates the perception, the potential for someone to suggest that enforcement action is taken on the basis of the depth of the pocket and not the magnitude of the violation. And that is both a practice and a perception that we have studiously sought to avoid in each of our prosecution decisions. It is, however, the situation that we find ourselves in because for several biennia since, the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Program in Oregon receives exactly zero general fund dollars.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have an additional question then.
Sure.
We have numerous bills that have been introduced at the request of Attorney General Hardy Myers for the Department of Justice. Have you introduced a bill to change that particular statutory scheme as far as it relates to how your dollars flow for that particular work that the agency does?
That's a fair question, Senator Starr. And the answer is in this session we have not. In prior sessions we have sought in the Ways and Means process, however, to receive general fund resources for that program. And we've said to the Ways and Means Committee the very issue you and I are discussing, why we think it would be a more prudent policy to provide general fund for that program.
Thank you. Appreciate your answers.
Thank you. Any other questions by the committee? Okay. I believe, while there may be some additional questions, I believe the general protections for the public are important. I think we have to be able to make sure that the people who have asked to have a certain sense of privacy have a chance to be able to have that enforced, and it would be my desire to move forward on this piece of legislation, keeping in mind that this also, Mr. Cosgrove, buys another month of time in the House of Representatives, which I'm sure you will avail yourself of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we're in work session. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes Anderson.
I move Senate Bill 117 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson has moved Senate Bill 117 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator George.
I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest as I have own a company that does subcontract to these kind of firms.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Senator Starr.
Here. I appreciate the dialogue that Mr. Shepherd and I just enjoyed. I wish I could sit here and say that I think that all of the work that the Consumer Complaints Division does is right up, straight up. But I've become aware of some of the instances where the Department of Justice has what I would consider persecuted, not prosecuted, but persecuted Oregon businesses. And the assurance of voluntary compliance, though you don't have to go to court, basically the businesses don't have a lot of choice, and they're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines, and really, in my mind, aren't necessary. It's an issue that's not connected completely with this no-call program, but I'm uncomfortable with providing the Attorney General this kind of authority in this particular instance, especially when the civil penalties that could be levied just go back into the program. You know, Mr. Shepherd himself said that they're not even comfortable with that, and yet they've brought a number of other bills, but they don't bring a bill from the Attorney General to rectify that particular issue. I am sympathetic to Oregonians who are part of the no-call program that continue to get phone calls. I don't believe that this is the right answer to rectify that problem. I understand that this bill will likely move over my objections, and maybe we can continue to work on it in the House.
Thank you, Senator. Any other comments? Okay, would you take the roll?
Senator Decker?
Aye.
Senator George?
No.
Senator Montes-Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Chair Metzger?
Aye.
Having received a constitutional majority, Senate Bill 117 is declared passed, and I guess I will carry the bill. Okay. Senator Atkinson, may I ask, is he here? I thought I saw him earlier. No? Okay. Make sure I don't miss anybody. I think what I'm going to do here, we're going to move out of order temporarily. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 566. I know Commissioner Adams is here, so I'm going to ask him to come forward. We're going to hear from Commissioner Adams' colleagues, and then we're going to go back to the top of the agenda because he has, you know, good things he needs to do for the city of Portland or to the city of Portland, depending on the perspective. But we appreciate you taking the time to come with us to you twice in 2 weeks. It's pretty good.
I know.
Welcome, tired. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be back to talk about the Congestion Relief Act of 2007, and I want to thank you, Chair Metzger, for your leadership on transportation funding in addition to your colleagues on the committee. We understand that a solution to the transportation system funding crisis will require time, commitment, and planning. And your willingness to both do something in the short term and long term is appreciated by the City of Portland and cities all across the state of Oregon. The Congestion Relief Act of 2007 provides necessary improvements to our freight routes and establishes a means to reduce congestion. Portland is proud to serve as one of the transportation hub for Oregon's system. But without additional resources in local street safety maintenance, preservation needs, and expansion of capacity, the system will be gridlocked. A few examples of the impacts to the cities and the larger state's economy. $884 million is the cost of congestion in the year 2025 to the economy of Portland and the surrounding region. $327 million is the cost to bring up our transportation assets from poor to good. That's not an expansion of capacity in any way, just in trying to get a ding on the backlog. And $450 million is the gruesome statistic based on National Transportation Safety Board numbers of the cost, the impact of the cost of deaths and injuries on Portland's streets. So, as the Commissioner of Transportation, I am committed to continuously improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the Portland Office of Transportation. And when we get to be the most efficient and effective local transportation system in the United States, I still will not have enough resources to meet the growing demand, to meet and address the safety issues, and to reduce congestion and the maintenance issues. So while the longer-term solutions are worked on by a variety of stakeholders, and I believe that ultimately an increase in the gas tax is necessary, in the meantime, I want to thank you for taking up the consideration of the Congestion Relief Act of 2007, and the City of Portland, along with the Oregon League of Cities, stands by and ready to assist in any way that we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Adams. And colleagues, as you notice, this is, as we'll talk about this more in detail later, but this is added to 566, which is the commissioner previously testified regarding, you know, when you have an accident, getting your vehicle off the side of the road. So I don't want people to think that the only thing we're doing for congestion is getting your car off the side of the road. But that's part of it, and it works. Mm-hmm. I have one question for you, and then if the committee has any members, otherwise we'll dismiss you at that point. But I was on a tour of southern Oregon counties affected by the potential loss of federal funding, and which transportation is part of it. When we were, and I apologize since I didn't ask you this in advance, so if you don't have the answer, it's okay. But when we were in Coos County, they specifically asked a question, Commissioner Nikki Whitty, and asked if we could make some adjustments in the law, which the presumption is that the law is prescriptive, to allow them to use some of their OTIA 3 bridge, this is the county bridge money, and because I know you're a major recipient of that, county bridge money that was left over after successfully completing the projects that were on their list, but they actually did them cheaper and had money left over, so that they could use them for other transportation needs, and that the law was didn't allow them to do that. It was only for bridges, and they had the stuff done. I'm examining that for that particular case, but I was just wondering, Commissioner, do you know where, under your responsibility with Multnomah County and your relationship with Multnomah County to provide mm-hmm. for the Portland bridges, where we are in that in terms of Do you have a similar issue? Have you been able to perform those projects and have an idea of whether they required all of your funds or maybe additional funds or whether there was any savings and whether that might be an issue at all between you and your partner in Multnomah County?
I'll have to get back to you with a specific answer on whether we've achieved any savings and how much that savings was. I can tell you that the city of Portland has 157 bridges that we are responsible for. Not a single one crosses the Willamette River, but you will all use the 157 bridges if you travel to the Portland airport or practically any place else in the Portland region anytime soon. A third of those bridges are considered in poor condition, and another third are not up to seismic regulations. So I will get you back a specific answer to your question, and it would be great to be able to use those on some of our failing bridges that we have many of.
Yeah, we'll just be curious if there were any restrictions in which we could be helpful in making sure that other infrastructure like that was done. We'll look forward to that.
Great.
Questions for the commissioner? Senator Decker.
Mr. Chair, what is the Congestion Relief Act of 2007?
That is what we're going to be doing in 566 more extensively. It's the part of which is the Dash 4 amendment. 566.
Okay, so I'm not supposed to know what's coming up. It's coming up. Okay. I didn't know.
It's part of our overall transportation bills and packages to help improve in our highway infrastructure. It actually involves a number of bills, one of which will be these amendments to 566.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions for the commissioner?
Just trying to think of some, you know, snappy question about the tram or the couplet, but I just can't think of anything. So
I've got snappy answers, but you've got better things to do.
Commissioner, thank you for coming once again.
Appreciate all your work.
Okay, we're going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 566. And Janet, should we go to 350? What's Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 863. Ask Mr. Shepherd to come forward. Actually, colleagues aren't going to move it today, but we'll get the amendment in because we'll just hear from him because he's here today. So, rather than ask him to come back, colleagues, 863 is the automated dialing call bill that we heard a couple of times. We have a Dash 3 amendment. There were a number of issues that were brought up in that hearing that I worked to address in that. And Mr. Shepherd, you've reviewed those Dash 3 amendments. Could you tell us, review for the committee, what the changes are as reflected in the Dash 3? And by the way, our staff, Ms. Atkins, has provided you a handy gross edition of what 863 would look like with the Dash 3.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and there are two significant differences between the Dash 3s and the version that you looked at previously, and both happen to relate to questions that came from members of your committee. The first question, I believe, came from Senator George and concerned the provisions of the earlier version that related to the consumption, if you will, of the recording capacity of a recipient's call. Those provisions are out of the Dash 3 amendments, and the Department of Justice supports the removal of those. They don't do a lot of additional injury to the consumer, and it seems to us they avoid an entanglement in what otherwise would be an equal privileges and immunities potential constitutional challenge. And as I told the committee before, we're certain to have constitutional litigation about this under Article 1, Section 8 anyway, and that will perhaps help simplify that. So we support that feature of the Dash 3s. The other significant difference between the Dash 3s and the version that you looked at before relates to a question Senator Starr had about the magnitude of the penalty, and as you recall in the previous version, by invoking the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the maximum civil penalty that could be applied by the Attorney General for a given violation was $25,000. And what the Dash 3 amendments do is cap that maximum at $5,000. The Department of Justice is not supportive of that feature of the Dash 3s, but we think they're workable, and we can live with that kind of an operation. So we don't oppose dash threes. We think they're consistent with the spirit of the previous amendments that we supported, and so for that reason we'd be in support of the dash threes.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. And two other changes that are reflected in the amendment, colleagues. One is Ms. Brown had some concerns, who's in the audience, and we rectified those without changes in the bill. Those questions were answered satisfactorily. And then Mr. Marquis, representing debt collectors, was concerned just about some of the language, had recommended that we just delete the debt collectors from the definition of a caller and therefore would take care of the rest of it, which is also in the dash three amendment. So I really appreciate all those comments that that you had. And so what while it doesn't have as many of the things in there, I think it still gets to the prescriptive harms, specifically the manipulation of ID, you know, not taking up a person's line where they can't get a dial tone. And if they, you know, indicated they don't want to be called to respect those types of privacies. But I think your point was very well taken, Senator George, with the answering machine, basically that would take them all out because you do leave messages. And so except that it might be a cell phone where you are paying by the minute, except for that exception, that would no longer would be an issue. Questions either about the amendments or to Mr. Shepherd about anything? Okay. What I would like to do is adopt the dash three amendment today, and we'll move the bill probably tomorrow.
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 863. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 863. Now, Janet. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd, for hanging around. Let's see. What do we? Okay. Let's go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 350. Janet. Feels like the last week of session, doesn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 350, we've had a couple of chances to hear about. This is the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department's reorganization of their statutes as a result of a budget note from last session directing them to undertake a review of their statutes and to bring some consistency and streamlining. There's a certain amount of combining of funds. There's elimination of the statute, some statutory courts division and things like that you've already heard about. We had a dash one amendment that was pretty hefty, and now those are the dash four amendments. There were several just errors in drafting and some confusing things that were taken care of in the dash fours. We ran out of time at the hearing on the dash ones because we also have a dash two. That's a smaller amendment that's at your place today, and that's at the request of the Division of State Lands, and there was no time to hear from Luis Soliday about the dash two amendments. And they allow the director of the Department's Division of State Lands to authorize withdrawal of mitigation bank credits by a public benefit corporation or public body at the request of a mitigation bank sponsor. Mr. Chair, there are people from the department. If you have any questions about the, these are their amendments, the department's amendments, the dash fours.
I will. I think what I'll do first, because it could raise questions, and that way we'll have people reacting to everything that's on the table, is ask Mr. Shiprack to come forward, because he wanted to make some comments, and I think I'll have him do that, and then we'll have folks come up in case there's something that needs to be responded to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I guess first a question to the committee administrator. We had the dash threes.
Your issue is on the in the dash fours. It's on page 18, bottom of page 18.
It was taken care of in the dash fours.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I know you're busy, and I really appreciate the opportunity just to make a couple comments. The dash three amendments, for your information, was a single sentence in this long bill, which would have taken the agency out completely from the public contracting code and eliminated the requirement to pay prevailing wages on their public works projects, a rather significant change in public policy, so I'm glad that that's been rectified. I want to take, with your indulgence, just 1 minute to bring you up to speed on why this issue is so important to us. And I want to talk about for 1 minute the latest enterprise zone. This one happens to be in the city of Albany. It's a Gatorade plant that's going to be sited there. There's currently already a plant in Oakland, California. But Pepsi-Cola wants to build another one, probably close the one in Oakland. They first went to West Sacramento with this plant. West Sacramento offered numerous tax credits for the jobs. The city wanted to charge Gatorade for the cost of the water and sewer expansions, however, to accommodate the new plant. Gatorade refused to pay those costs and withdrew its application and came to Oregon. They want to build a bottling plant and a bottle manufacturing plant. The company is doing business as SVC Manufacturing. The local economic development agency will obtain the options on 193 acres and transfer the rights to the company. Later, the city of Albany must buy back five of those acres from Gatorade at $125 per acre, $125,000 per acre, and pay for the construction of a reservoir for SVC's use. This has a whopping 15-year property tax abatement attached to it, given a $15 per thousand maximum rate under Measure 50. That's a savings of $36 million to the company. They also will pay a project fee of about only half the Measure 50 maximum property tax rate, a savings of another $9 million. They expect to get tax breaks under the Pollution Control, Business Energy, and Business Development Tax Exemption Regulations. The city must obtain a loan of 14.2. There's traffic mitigation, millions more of public subsidies. In the interest of time, I'll just say that my researcher, oh, by the way, all this came out of the development agreement signed between the state, local government, and SVC dated October 26, 2006. We calculate the public breaks and abatements, grants, loans, and everything else at $62 million for this project. Why do I bring this up, and why were we upset about the proposed amendment, which has been deleted? Throughout all these discussions, and I spoke to the county commissioner who put this project together working with the State Economic Development Department and others, not once was a question asked, where is your construction workforce going to come from? Pepsi-Cola Gatorade has hired a large contractor from Jacksonville, Florida, very capable of bringing their own workforce to Albany, Oregon, and yet none of our elected or paid officials bothered to suggest that maybe we should have some language in here to hire Oregon people. There's a possibility this 3.2 million square foot facility could be built without any Oregon workers on it. And I just want to bring this to your attention. This is the crap that's going on out there. And I've talked about this for two sessions. It's too late to make amendments to this bill in the Senate, but rest assured I'm going to raise these issues in the House and try and get some people's attention to start taking care of what they profess these programs are for, and that's family wage jobs for Oregonians. And yet this is the latest example of where that's not happening. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shiprock. I mean, you bring up some very valid points because we're all very, very concerned about making sure that Oregonians have access to good jobs, and that's why state assistance is one of the things that we do consider providing if we believe it's going to have an impact, a positive impact economically for not only the state but for Oregon families. We're going to hear, it's going to be the briefest hearing you've ever heard, a priority bill of mine because we're near the end of the Senate. I only had a chance to write one paragraph, so it's actually a bill in progress, but dealing with the issue in enterprise zones and employer reporting of actual jobs created, and it'll be a work in progress, but at least we'll have a chance to work on it and develop it more in the House. To make sure that workers, that there is accountability for the tax breaks that we give, that they actually benefit our local communities and the people who live there. So, questions for Mr. Shiprock? Okay. Thank you for your comments. Mr. Repine, you want to walk us through, not page by page, but because we had a week to look at your amendments, but to tell us the changes. I think I'd also like you to refer to Mr. Shiprock's comments because I believe some of those omissions were not intended. So I think that's also important to have on the record.
Obviously, Mr. Shipacker has a different opinion. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am Bob Reapline, Director of Economic and Community Development. Regarding the amendments that Mr. Shipwreck talked about, those were not intended to be in the bill. They were not driven by the agency, and we were just they were brought to my attention just this week by Commissioner Gardner. When I got the call or the FaceTime with the commissioner, I immediately asked my staff about it. We found out that there was there was deficiencies in the way the bill was written, and we corrected that immediately.
One thing, too, just for the record, I want to say, because staff, we did check with Legislative Council, Ms. Janelle Barton, who wrote this, and commented to us that this was not intentional, that it was an error that in her drafting, so it was not a direction by anyone. So, but the bottom line is it was corrected, and I appreciate that that has been done. Go ahead with others changes. Any other changes or comments?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, again, Bob Reapline, Director of Economic and Community Development. Mr. Grove will probably go through those changes, but again, we went through the bill as your committee administrator mentioned. We in the dash one original amendments, as we all were seeing it for the first time when the bill was presented to this committee, we felt comfortable with what we had reviewed in the fourth row in the other hearing room. But as we spent a little more time looking at some of the details, there were a couple issues that had fallen out, were not correct, and so with the dash four amendments now, we feel very comfortable that the amendment and the bill that's in front of you today reflects the intent and the spirit of which the bill was submitted to originally. And there's, I think, three other items that Mr. Grove will talk to you about.
Okay.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Paul Grove with Economic and Community Development Department. As has already been noted, we cleaned up the language in Section 8 regarding public works. That was not intentional, and that was cleaned up immediately. Another change that took place with or error that we found needed to be corrected in the dash ones occurred in Section 3 regarding commission membership. The bill had changed a requirement that commission members, there be at least two members from east of the Cascades, and that was not our goal, nor were we directed by the commission to change that particular part of the statute. So we corrected that error to have the requirement be at least one member from east of the Cascades. A third change relates to Section 14 as far as services that we could contract for relating to small businesses. There was reference to the word venture, and we're not in the business of contracting out our services as it relates to that topic. So we deleted that reference to venture from the statute or from the bill. A fourth change involves the Regional Investment Fund, and this dealt with the reporting and evaluation requirements, and we just wanted to clarify that the department, it would be the department that would be evaluating what the Regional Investment Board would be submitting in terms of their regional investment strategies and their performance requirements. So we just wanted to clean up that language. And then in Section 72, there was another drafting error that we cleaned up as far as the language was concerned to make it consistent.
Okay, thank you. Questions for anyone in the panel about the amendments or changes? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just as a final comment, the dash two amendments that
I was going to ask Ms. Soliday to come forward.
Again, I just wanted to add my support to those amendments. Again, I think last time we were together, we mentioned the reason we chose not to fold those into our original bill was that the commission, the Economic Development Commission, who's worked with us on creating the Senate Bill 350 language, had not had any prior information over those amendments, and we felt we owed them the opportunity to have their introductions be made without other amendments to the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Hold on, guys. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, did we get anywhere on the International Trade Commission? I know that there's an executive order forthcoming on that. Can you share anything if we're going to eliminate? I'm somewhat familiar with the commission. I think this might be a good suggestion for the International Trade Commission, but I'd like to kind of know what's next for this group.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Deckert, for the record, Mike Salzgiver, I'm deputy director of the department. The current discussion going on, first and foremost, the governor's office strongly supports keeping the international trade advisory capability together. What is the intent of this bill is to remove the number of separate commissions and councils in statute and have that international trade function report through an expanded economic development commission. The executive order will reflect that, will reflect the new strategic plan that the International Trade Commission adopted last fall. And we expect to see the final executive order language imminently. It's being drafted right now.
And we'll see it imminently. Sure.
We'll certainly be happy to provide that to you as soon as we get it.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you. Ms. Sullivan, you want to come forward about your Dash 2 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. I think, as most of you are aware, the Economic Revitalization Team has worked over the last several years to certify industrial sites around Oregon to get them shovel-ready for companies who are interested in locating in the state of Oregon. And while we've certified over 75 sites, we're now to the point where we've got another tier of sites identified which have some significant problems associated with them, one of those problems being the amount of wetlands that appear on those properties. And we have had a subgroup of the Economic Revitalization Team working on looking at how to deal with the wetland issues that these properties have. And one of the recommendations that they've made, which is reflected in this amendment, is that under DSL's current statutes for the removal fill law, a credit in a mitigation bank can only be purchased when there is a removal fill permit that's being issued by the department that needs to be mitigated for because of the impacts on wetlands. This bill would allow a public body or a public corporation to actually buy those credits in advance of a development occurring and holding them for development when it does occur. So it gives us a little bit of some flexibility with our mitigation banking program that those credits could be purchased in advance, held, and then used and applied to a project that needs a removal fill permit from us that has wetland mitigation requirements with it. So we're trying to give ourselves a new tool in the toolbox. The department would have to monitor this pretty closely to make sure that those credits are only used once to mitigate for impacts on the landscape related to wetland impacts, but we believe we have the ability to do that through our permitting process and our tracking of the mitigation banking credit system that we have operating in the state of Oregon today. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Miles Anderson.
Just a clarification. I don't know how the tax credits, how many credits you have. I mean, what determines, where do those credits come from?
Mr. Chair and Senator Miles Anderson, those credits are based on wetland functions that are being established across the landscape. They're based on acreage of the size of the wetland mitigation bank that's being credited. We have a crediting system. We have a program where mitigation banks are reviewed and certified by our department. We have a committee of folks who go out and certify those banks. We release credits based on meeting the established criteria for wetland functions on the landscape. So those credits are released over a period of time as vegetation is established, hydrology is established, those sorts of things.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In lines 13 and 14 of the amendments, and maybe I just misunderstand how these credits are used, but it says the director, for the purposes of reserving credits for future use, we're not trying to, I guess we don't want to use, in most of these mitigation banks, is it a situation where they're in competition for private users who want to use certain credits that are in mitigation banks, and could this provide a situation where you could create a sort of a crisis of credits, I guess, is what I'm looking at.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I would say the crisis of credits is upon us because we have more demand than we have supply currently, which is actually driving additional entrepreneurs to go out and develop mitigation banks. So I think there's a good thing happening on the landscape as a result of this program. Currently, a public body who's already got a project ready to go, who needs a permit for it, can come in, apply for the permit, and can withdraw credits from a bank to do the wetland mitigation that's needed for that site. So what we're doing is creating an opportunity for somebody to actually purchase those credits in advance. It could create a shortage for ready-to-go projects that are out there. I suppose we'll see how this works. It does give us the discretion to say yay or nay, and so you'll notice that we don't open this up to the whole world. It's public entities, the idea being a local government or an economic development corporation or a council of governments would be the most likely entities who would want to try and do this for anticipated development.
Follow, Mr. Chair. It seems like to me that here's what you could have. You could have a local entity reserving credits, seeing that there perhaps could be a shortage 12 months, 18 months down the road. So they come to the department, have credits reserved, and then you would have a private entity or some other entity that doesn't qualify under the statute want to get credits for a project ready to go today, and you could create artificial crises with this particular language, and I'm wondering if you'd respond to that.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I guess, you know, the department will have to monitor this new tool to see how it's going to work on the landscape. It's important to understand that the local entity would actually have to pay for those. It's not just reserving the credits. They're going to have to buy them in advance. So I don't think you're going to have a lot of folks rushing out buying these things. They tend to be expensive. Right now are the cost of a mitigation credit, they're set by the private bankers, not by us, but they run from probably about $60,000 a credit to as high as between $150,000 and $200,000 a credit, depending on what economic area you're in. The banks in the Portland area being the most expensive, and once you get away from there, being less expensive. So you're not going to a rush here to buy because it's not inexpensive to do. And some of these industrial sites that we're looking at certifying in this next tier, some of them have a couple hundred acres of wetlands, so you're not going to rush out and buy the mitigation credits you need for a site like that. So I think there's probably going to be limited use for this. We are bringing on more banks. Each bank has a service area that it services. It's generally the watershed in which the bank is created. So you can't, for instance, if you're the city of Eugene and you're anticipating some company coming in, you can't buy credits from the Portland Bank to mitigate for the Eugene area. You have to buy credits from banks that are within that particular service area. So there's some limitations in terms of how far reaching this tool may be used in the state.
Sure. Just a follow-up. So you have an interesting scenario then. Let's say, for instance, the city of Eugene did not like a project the city of Springfield or the city of Junction City was doing. They had resources. They could buy up the mitigation bank credits in advance of a private entity getting to those same mitigation banks as a way to deflect some kind of competing folks in there. I mean, you see what I'm saying? Here's what's happening is we're putting these people in the front of the line with this particular amendment. It's making me very nervous because if it's equal access at the same time, it's a just-in-time situation here for
me. Mr. Chair and Senator George, I am told by those who work in the mitigation banking field that there is a way for a private company to reserve credits in advance also. They normally are paying some small percentage of the cost of a credit, 10% or something like that. And so from talking to some of our wetland consultants, there already is a way for a private company to get in line before they're actually doing their development.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So that's the Dash 2 amendment. We have a Dash 4 amendment. The bill also goes to Ways and Means. It would be my desire to move it on.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 350.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 350. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 350.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 350. Just further discussion?
Mr. Chair? I think I would like to object to these particular amendments until I got some additional information on some of the questions that I raised. I don't necessarily have any problem with the concept. These make me just a little bit nervous because I know how competitive this market is right now, and so I'd like to just maybe voice an objection on these particular amendments because of that.
Okay. Any other comments? Any other objections besides Senator George? Okay. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the bill as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 350 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Further discussion? Objection to that motion. So ordered. We'll ask Senator Deckard to be excused. All right, what I'm going to do, it's always nice when you have big bills and little time, but I'm going to move ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 566. And colleagues, we have two amendments, one of which we have heard previously. But Janet, why don't you just tell us, because we're not using the original bill on 566. So if you could just review again briefly the dash 2 and then the dash 4 that we have.
Mr. Chair, the dash 2 amendments are incorporated into the dash, excuse me, the dash 2s are incorporated into the dash 4. So that
oh, they are?
The section 5 of the dash 4 includes that. The new provision that a driver would commit the offense of failure to remove a vehicle from the highway if, after an accident, they're not injured, the car is movable, and they don't move it off the highway. This is going to be a Class C traffic infraction if they fail to move the vehicle from the highway. You had a hearing on this portion of the amendment on the 12th. And this bill is a gut and stuff, so their original provisions dealing with recreational vehicles are no longer in the bill at all. And the dash 4 amendments are the new Joint Interim Committee on Transportation and giving and requiring an evaluation of transportation options, funding options. And then Section 2 is requiring the Oregon Transportation Commission to conduct a study with several specific components. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. So before I ask some people to testify, sign up to testify to come forward, what essentially this is, colleagues and people in the audience, is the beginning of our Congestion Relief Act of 2007 that Senator Decker was asking about. This actually is going to be contained in a number of bills, and it's our work. Senator Starr has worked a lot on this, as well as our counterparts in the House. Is to work at trying to address our overall transportation needs in the state. And there's a number of fronts that have to be done on this. I know we have all heard and read about the price of congestion. We had testimony in our committee. Different business groups have been organized to try and find other funding solutions. And so what Senate Bill 566 and the Dash 4 does is a number of key things. Number one, sets up the Joint Committee on Transportation for the interim to look at our existing statutes and how our local regional partners provide transportation funding, to look at if there are other models that we need to look at in terms of being able to provide for maintenance preservation and transportation infrastructure on regional levels rather than totally relying on our current system. And I believe that, and Senator Starr agrees, that this is a very complex issue, and it's going to take a lot of discussion, a lot of stakeholders, in order to come up with a solution that has tremendous buy-in that we can bring to the next legislative assembly. It's not something we do overnight. So we have a lot of folks that are concerned about that, and their expertise is going to be needed. The second part of the legislation directs to where we're going. I think we clearly understand we need more resources for transportation, particularly in some of our major projects, and we've had a lot of discussion about that in this committee. Those obviously are going to take real dollars, and but before we can get there, I am convinced, I think most of the folks that we have been working with on this issue understand that we need to make a very good case to the public as we ask them for more dollars for transportation as to what they're going to buy. And so that they are committed to what they're buying, that they want what they're buying, not asking for a lifeline of dollars without knowing where it's going to go. So Section 2 helps do a couple of things. Number one, it helps direct the Department of Transportation. Well, we're going to do an evaluation. This will also be under the supervision of the Joint Interim Transportation Committee. on existing real property owned by the Department of Transportation and find creative ways that we might be able to maximize a revenue stream from existing properties that may be underutilized for one reason or another. Because I think one important thing is we need to convey to the public that, first of all, we're trying to get as many dollars as we can out of our existing assets before we were to ask them for additional assets. We also want to make sure that we take a look at the current projects of statewide significance, as well as maybe other significant areas that may infrastructure improvements that need to be done, so that the department can look at those, can really put a fine pencil to them, can get a real understanding of what it takes to have those done, why they're important to the state, what is the actual construction timelines that could be expected. Because if we're going to go then ask to fund those projects, we want to make sure that they are as bulletproof as possible, that the questions are answered, that the case is made as to why we need to move forward on them. And so this is going to direct the commission to really focus on that, to tell us what we need in this state, why it's important, what can we expect if we ask for additional revenues, what can we expect to be the result, and why is it going to be significant. So this sets all of that in motion. I think it's a real critical part. We need a lot of stakeholders at the table. We understand that there is a critical time to get this stuff done, but we also have to do it thoughtfully because we're going to be going to the citizens of Oregon with our findings and asking for their buy-in that this is going to improve the economy of the state, and we need to have that discussion with them. So that's the basis for this part of the Congestion Relief Act. And we have a number of people set to testify. I'll ask Craig Campbell, Bob Russell, and Art Schlack to come forward. And so essentially we're talking the Dash 4 amendment is the bill. So welcome, gentlemen. It's always nice to see you guys all together, sitting together.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here representing AAA Oregon-Idaho in support of the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 566, and if adopted, then, of course, for the bill, Senate Bill 566, for a couple of reasons. One, we know that we have a tough road to hoe to make a good case for transportation funding outside of this building, and this starts a couple of key elements going so that we can have that discussion, and we will have some ammunition to provide to the public. Not in an education sort of way in the traditional sense, but so that the voters of Oregon are confident whenever they have to be put before a question of increasing transportation funding down the road, that they're sure that their money is being well spent and dealing with the type of issues that they're concerned about. One of the things I want to specifically comment about is traditionally AAA has had concerns about local transportation taxes because of the inability generally for those to reflect cost responsibility. So by having a discussion about how we might restructure that discussion in a way that would allow local folks to deal with issues when the state is unable to move, dealing with things like maintenance and preservation, that's a healthy discussion. We very much look forward to having that discussion. And also wanted to indicate that AAA is planning on being an active participant in both of the opportunities that have been set up herein. And although it's not as much a part of the bill, the Section 5, I wanted to indicate also that AAA, from a safety perspective, is supportive of that as well. Most people don't realize that a swarm of law enforcement and cameras for insurance purposes are not going to show up for every fender bender. It's usually much safer if you can get those cars off to the side of the road and allow traffic to continue unimpeded. And with that, I'm fully willing to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. I think we'll go ahead and Mr. Russell next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I, too, am here in support of the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 566. I think this is a very important step forward in addressing congestion on our highways. We're also very pleased to be here with Mr. Campbell from AAA, and here in agreement and supporting something that we think is very positive. Out of the Congestion Relief Act of 2007, we believe these two pieces are the sort of the cornerstone, the most important parts. And like Mr. Campbell, we like taking a different look at what's going on at the local level and within the regions. I think it's time to do that for a number of reasons. One, We haven't been able to provide adequate funding for local roads as we've done the transportation funding packages in the past. The locals have not gotten their full share of those revenues. So that's certainly there's a tremendous need that hasn't been satisfied. We're also cognizant of the expansion of MPOs in our state, which really are regional governments, and are taking a different look at transportation and how things work in the state. So we think that that is an extremely positive development to look at that those issues. The second thing, and the thing that we think is the cornerstone, for sure, is the congestion study that will be conducted with highway users, with the Federal Highway Administration, ODOT, and others. Like Senator Metzger, we totally agree that we need to develop a list of projects if we're going to convince the public to part with their hard-earned cash. And we look at this as a beginning because we fully expect that once the study's done, that we will work towards providing additional funding in future legislative sessions. And we also support the MOVE IT legislation. We think that that is going to help reduce congestion a little bit on our freeways. All too often we have seen folks with fender benders sitting on the hoods of their car in the middle lane on the freeway when and stopping all the traffic for miles behind them when they could just move it to the side of the road and we could all get by a lot quicker. And I too would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Well, I think we'll go to Mr. Slack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Here, I guess, to add another voice in support of the passage of Senate Bill 566 with the Dash 4 amendments. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you are to be congratulated on taking a step forward in looking at the overall transportation needs of the state of Oregon, something that has been long due. I think that this is certainly calling for the Joint Interim Committee on Transportation to take a look at maybe some new and creative opportunities to increase transportation funding is a very bold step and a very good step at this point. That is something that the Association of Oregon Counties is eagerly looking at participating in during the interim and in terms of this project. I know, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you have seen copies of the county's need report that was published in November, and I would just call to your attention that the counties have a documented need of over $433 million annually for the next 10 years at this point, and that need is... we also have, as you know, Mr. Chair, the 106393, the federal forest situation, which adds $90 million annually to the deficit of funds that the counties have had to date to deal with transportation in about 30 of the 36 counties across the state. So looking at additional funding for not only counties but the cities and the state is extremely important, and we think that moving forward with Senate Bill 566 is a very positive step.
Thank you, Mr. Slack. Questions for any of the three panelists? Okay, thank you. Andy Shaw and Doug Tindall.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. Passing out a report the cities have put together also talking about the need for investment in local roads and maintenance and preservation in particular. We're very encouraged by the leadership the Senate is providing and trying to move forward a discussion to provide more funding for our transportation system. We're discouraged, of course, that the action can't happen faster, but we are encouraged that there is some long-term strategic thinking about how to get from where we are now to a point where we can more adequately fund our road system. Our report talks about how the road system, both the statewide, county, and city road systems are vital to our economic future. I think the Oregon business community, the business council has given you compelling evidence to that as well. If you look on page 7 of the report, you can see a chart there that just shows how the costs to maintain our road system are skyrocketing while our revenues have remained quite flat. So we're not keeping pace with the growing costs. On page 9, I think this kind of research, and we're glad to join in the discussions in the interim, page 9 shows the variety of local sources of funding and the various approaches that different types of cities have taken to funding local road systems. You can see the difference between, say, Ashland, who has raised 64% of their street fund locally, to John Day, which has raised 82% of their resources locally. John Day is dependent almost wholly for that local funding from funds from the county that come from federal timber funds, so they too will feel the effects of the loss of those federal funds. But this, I think, shows you the variety of approaches and some of the creativity that locals have shown in trying to raise local funding. So cities are making efforts to fill the gap that's existed since the last tax increase in gas taxes in 1993, but we can't meet that on our own, and we are encouraged, again, that you're moving towards trying to help us fill that need. I would just point out, we really encourage you to keep maintenance and preservation at the top of your radar screen as this moves forward. If we increase capacity and create more roadways with the existing maintenance and preservation resources we have, we need to maintain more roads with the same amount of funds, and it makes a pretty tough situation worse if we don't keep maintenance and preservation funding on the top of our radar. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Tindall, welcome.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation. First, apologies on Director Garrett's behalf. He's having fun in Ways and Means, or at least he's in Ways and Means, and unable to be here, so I'm here today and to talk about the Senate Bill 566. I don't need to tell the committee, I don't think, the importance of transportation. I think you've heard that. You've heard from Mr. Schlack and Mr. Shaw that there's needs across the board, not only at the state level. We've done a presentation on the Oregon Transportation Plan, which identified all of the critical needs there are in transportation. We appreciate the Senate Bill 566 for bringing up new ideas to make use of the best use of available resources. We certainly agree with the chair that it's critical that we can show the public that we've done everything we can, and we will continue, regardless of whether this bill moves or not, we will take the tasks that are identified for the department and move forward with those tasks in the near future. So just in short, you already know this, the needs are documented. New source of revenue, I think, is probably a logical extension of the work Senator Starr led and the Road User Fee Task Force, searching for new ways to fund transportation. The needs are there. The need to increase revenues from any source is there today, and it increases every day. And we appreciate efforts to keep the critical additional transportation funding that will keep Oregon a healthy, livable state. With respect to Sections 4 and 5, we have no concerns relating to the requirement to move vehicles off the road after the crash. It may likely facilitate clearing of crashes, which will reduce congestion. And again, the committee's had the benefit of seeing presentations that show just how costly congestion is. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tindall. Questions for either of our witnesses? Well, thank you both. We will be spending a lot of time at the table working on these issues and look forward to your input in advancing transportation.
Thanks.
Thank you, General. If there's no one else signed to testify, we are in public hearing. So go to a work session on Senate Bill 566 with our Dash 4.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 566.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 566. Further discussion?
Yes. Janet, and Mr. Chair, I apologize. Can you walk through quickly what's in the Dash 4s just so I vote informed? And
go ahead, Janet, if you'd like.
Section 1 creates a joint interim committee on transportation, and we'll have 5 House members and 5 Senate members. Gives them tasks to look at the needs analyze current statutes available to political subdivisions to address transportation needs, and also to evaluate the creation of regional transportation utility districts or other regional bodies that might address transportation. Mr. Chair, then Section 2 is giving direction to the Oregon Transportation Committee for several, a commission for several studies. And Section 5 is unrelated to these provisions. Was an amendment requested by the City of Portland about creating a violation if you fail to move your vehicle after an accident and the vehicle is drivable and there's no injuries to the driver.
Any other questions? No. Sarah Moss.
I know some people said this is a bold step, and I can't really say it's really a bold step, but it's a step in the right direction, but we need to be hopefully far more bolder than keep studying our transportation needs. The city of Gresham needs about $4 million each year to repair its roads, and due to the severely distressed general fund that supports our core services, you know, like public safety, our city streets fund really receives no supplemental income from the general fund, and so hopefully with this interim committee, it truly will not just study it, but really come out with specific recommendations that we can then go to the voters, if that is the decision, but do that, because I think 2 years is just not soon enough for me, but thank you.
Thank you, Senator Meyer-Sandren, and very, very valid point, and I think that part of the objective here is to come up with a very specific recommendation and have the public engaged in that. But to the second point about the urgency, you also articulated an issue that we're also very concerned about, and tomorrow you'll have an opportunity to talk about providing immediate money to get that process started with Senate Joint Resolution 33. Other questions? Okay. Any objection to did we make a motion?
I think it did.
Yeah, we did. Any objection to the motion?
Oh, that was for the amendment.
Yeah, for the amendment. Okay, not so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move on Senate Bill 566 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 566 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Just, I want to agree with you, and you talked about having to put together a process, and I think that it's important that we. What's in this bill really is the foundation for a much broader conversation to occur in 2009, and I think it's critical that we do these steps, and it's kind of the pre-work leading up to a larger package, and it's critical. I think it's really important. Ultimately, we have to get the votes in this building, and you know, if and at some level, the folks outside, the citizens, our constituents have to understand the needs, and I think the work that we're going to be doing here as an interim committee and the commission is critical to our long-term success. So I appreciate this bill and appreciate your leadership.
Sir, any other discussion? Senator Stecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just agreeing that I don't think, I mean, I'm happy to and appreciate this bill, but I don't think the problem is within the legislature. It could be, and I could be wrong, in terms of getting the votes for a transportation package. I think we need to see the external, and I hate the word business community and cities, but it really has to be that to get a big transportation package passed. I just think we're going to need to see not one or two, but 100 or 200 consistent support for a big transportation package. So hopefully this will help provide some form for a bigger conversation on transportation funding.
Absolutely, Senator. That's a very good point. And I know Senator Starr and I and others in this audience have, in fact, we had one meeting with about 60 people, as I recall, with a lot of business leaders. That point was brought up and also reflected back from us. That leadership is needed in a lot of different categories in order to advance transportation funding, because it is important. And it was very clear that, at least from our Oregon Business Association, the Oregon Business Council, the Portland Business Association, that they're willing to step up and help not only provide long-term stability to our infrastructure, but also a clarion call to whatever action we can do now and willing to step up. And so what we're trying to do here over a period of a few of these bills, this is sets up the look at how do we do long-term and get that in place. And but they've also asked, can we do something now? And they're willing to exert their leadership on that. And so tomorrow we're going to have that on the table to discuss possibilities of doing that, and we'll see what they have to say about that tomorrow. So any other questions? Any objections to the motion?
I'll ask Senator Starr and myself to carry that bill. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 350. Janet. Oh, excuse me, not 350. I meant 965. Excuse me. I lose track of numbers. I got BD reversal. Senate Bill 965. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure you don't want to do 350 again? Oh, okay.
It might be easier. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had a hearing on Senate Bill 965, and this is a high-cost home loan bill. You had a hearing in April on the subject, and at the beginning of the month on the subject, and a work group has been formed since, and Kate Newhall in the majority office is going to talk about the work group process. You have in front of you the dash twos and the dash fours. The dash twos, both amendments replace the entire bill, and they're mutually exclusive. You probably wouldn't adopt both of them. The dash two amendments, just for a little bit of clarification, apply to mortgage bankers and consumer finance lenders that do exempt banks and credit unions. And there's a number of things that are required of lenders. One of the main things is giving due regard to a borrower's ability to repay the loan, considering the borrower's current and expected income. It does not allow loans that have negative amortization, except for reverse mortgages and something that is known in the financial world as jumbo loans, and those are defined by in federal mortgage association. They do prohibit the amendments do prohibit prepayment penalties after the first year of a loan, except again for jumbo loans. The amendments prohibit loan flipping that has no tangible net benefit to the borrower. It also prohibits provisions that allow lenders the discretion to accelerate required payments. Mr. Chair, there's also a provision prohibiting financing of credit insurance in a home loan, and this bill also provides enforcement provisions for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. There is an emergency clause on the, again, on the dash twos. The dash four amendments also would replace the bill, and they codify guidelines that have been currently established by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors and the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators. And these would become standard for Oregon home loans, and these would apply to all lenders. Banks and credit unions would not be exempt from these provisions. Mr. Chair, there's also emergency clause on the dash four amendments.
Okay, thank you. You want to come forward? Members, and I want to thank Ms. Atkins, spent a lot of time on this as well. But we had a number of work groups I sat in on just brief parts of it. But we had a number of work groups, three or four, I think, regarding this. And a couple of different approaches. The dash two kind of reflects some of the general forms of where we felt we needed to go in terms of being, you know, protecting consumers and also providing balance for lenders. And part of the thing that came up in discussion of where to go was it was brought to us from the lenders, these federal guidelines, and a suggestion that that would be the way to go. And so I agreed that that might be an approach. So at their agreement, I asked to have those written up to codify in our law, which is the dash four, which basically encompasses a number of issues, some of which are included in the dash two, some aren't, but is a standard policy as guidelines on a federal level that we would make Oregon law. And so I took their suggestion and did that, and that's what we have before us. And welcome, if you can identify yourself and kind of walk us through what these do and how we got to where we are today.
Okay. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I work in the Senate Majority Office. I'm here, Senator Metzger, or Chair Metzger, members of the committee, just to testify a little bit about the process that we went through with the work group. Coming out of that first meeting, the chair the first public hearing that we held, the chair requested that we put together a work group of stakeholders and see if we could find some sort of consensus on appropriate amendments to Senate Bill 965. Just to give you a quick overview, the work group included different folks from the lending industry, different consumer advocates, as well as folks from the DCBS. The work group met, I think, five times over the course of about a week and a half. We ran through a long list of issues and concerns that folks had with what at that time were the Dash 1 amendments. That was what the work group was working from. We also ran through some of the specific lending practices and protections that some of the consumer advocates and sponsors of the bill were looking to address in Senate Bill 965. So I would say while we had some broad agreement on certain issues and practices that should be regulated in Senate Bill 965, we definitely did not reach consensus on all of the issues that we are looking at. But just to give you an idea, I think the work group came to agreement on issues like there should be some sort of ability to repay standard. We should also have some sorts of limits on negative amortization. But through that process, I think we also heard concerns from folks in the lending industry about the creation of new triggers for specific products and concerns that they had about compliance with different sets of standards between federal and state laws. During those conversations, I think we did have a lot of conversations about the guidelines, which all of the lenders around the table said that they were adhering to and following. So I think that right around the time I think that we were having those conversations, we also Minnesota passed a law that was similar to some of the things that we were looking at doing, and I think this was about a week and a half ago. But back to sort of the compliance issues and making sure that if you did have – sorry, let me back up a second. I think one of the concerns and why Minnesota was an example that we were looking at is because what Minnesota did was it took a couple of the practices that I think folks around the table had agreed to could be problematic, and it applied those certain standards broadly to all loans made in Minnesota. So you didn't have this sort of different issue of things that would trigger state law versus things that would trigger federal law. And so what Minnesota did is take sort of three standards and ability to repay, a standard on loan churning, which is flipping how we referred to it in Senate Bill 965, and limits on negative amortization, and applied those broadly to all loans made in the state. So that, I think, that those conversations are reflected in the Dash 2 amendments that we had drafted at the request of one of the sponsors of the bill. I think during that time, we were right about coming to the end of the work group. The chair was having further conversations with folks in the lending industry about codifying those guidelines into statute, which is what you see reflected in the Dash 4 amendments. I will say in those amendments that all of the substantive provisions in Sections 4 through 9 come directly from those banking guidelines. I think that sort of brings us through where we went and the broadly the topics that we discussed and worked on through the work group. I would be happy to answer any questions that anybody has.
Okay. Any process questions, Ms. Newhall, since it's kind of her role there? Thank you. We may have some later. I see we have the director here. Tori, would you like to come forward, Mr. Catlin, or it's just yourself, or... It's wonderful to have you here, so we'd like to get your feedback on the work that has been produced before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and for the record, I am Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tapman, the Administrator for our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I'm happy to be here today to comment on these amendments. We did share with you a few weeks ago when the bill was up for the first time some of our perspectives on the lending industry and some of the practices that we were seeing that were of concern. These amendments, I will say the Dash 4 amendments, as the chair and committee staff presented, do reflect the guidelines which are in place in Oregon today in the form of guidelines. They were promulgated at the national level to become effective for nationally regulated financial institutions. The federal regulators encouraged state regulators to put the same guidelines forward for state-regulated financial institutions. We've done so. Roughly 30 other states have done so. What the Dash 4 amendments would do would put them in statute to make violations of those guidelines directly enforceable, and we would have no problem moving forward with the Dash 4 amendments. We think these are best practices that the good players in the industry already comply with, and establishing them in law and providing enforcement authority, we think would establish a level playing field and bring everybody up to the standard that we'd like to see. One of the most important provisions in those guidelines is a requirement to ensure that to consider the borrower's ability to repay, not only with respect to the first payments, but to payments over the life of the loan. And these guidelines apply to non-traditional mortgage products, that is, products which have one of a number of features that create the potential for abuse. So making sure that, for example, someone who has an introductory period or an interest-only period or a negative amortization period can afford not only to make that original loan, but can actually afford to repay the loan over the life of the loan is very important, we think. There are also disclosure requirements that advertising and other materials make clear to the borrower what the loan actually consists of. And as I said, the putting them in statute would give us good ability to enforce them. The one issue I would just flag for you with respect to the Dash 4 amendments is the enforcement tools would require us to go to court and use civil enforcement authority through a litigation process. If you move forward with these amendments, what we would probably suggest over on the other side is to add cease and desist authority, which is a standard enforcement tool, which is a more streamlined approach. It's less costly for us, less costly for the entity that's potentially violated. It goes through an administrative hearings process, and for the less serious violations, it's often an appropriate tool. So that's the one issue that we identified in the Dash 4s that we would suggest fine-tuning. With respect to the Dash 2s, they take quite a different approach. In some ways stronger, in some ways less strong from a consumer protection standpoint. They do not apply to all types of financial institutions. They apply only to mortgage lending and consumer lending institutions, not to more traditional banks and credit unions. They do not have the disclosure provisions in them. They do prohibit some specific types of activities, some of which we've identified as significant problems. For example, flipping, that is encouraging the refinance of a loan that doesn't provide any financial benefit to the borrower. They do also require, as the Dash 4s do, they require examination of the borrower's ability to repay. And this would apply not just to those non-traditional loans, but to a broad variety of loans. The Dash 2s would also prohibit some practices like prepayment penalties and negative amortization, which may have a place in certain circumstances in the market. So one of the things we're looking at with respect to the Dash 2s, if we were making suggestions with respect to the Dash 2s, I think what we said to you at the original hearing is the combination of negative amortization and a prepayment penalty that basically locks someone in to a loan that gets them further in the hole, we see as a problem. Whether a blanket prohibition of prepayment penalties or a blanket prohibition of negative amortization is the way to go, however, that raises some different types of issues. I would point out also the Dash 2s have criminal penalties for violations. The Dash 4s are more of our standard civil enforcement tools. So both David and I would be happy to answer any questions that you've got.
Thank you. And one thing I would ask members, if we do not have anyone coming in at 3 o'clock, so if possible we could stay as long as we can, and so we won't move the bill today just because I want the other members here, but I'd like to get as much of this done as possible, and I understand everybody has deals, so we'll try to get through that. Just to let you know is that, you know, my intent is to move either the dash 2 or dash 4, realizing that we probably would still have some refining to do, but again, because of our deadlines, I think the issue is important enough, and I think a lot of work has been done on us in a positive way, so I kind of want to see what direction we go, which one we're going to continue to refine. I think what I'll ask, rather than ask questions because of the time frame at the moment, I'll let you step aside. I want to hear from the department. I'd like to hear from others on this. First of all, would you like to come forward, the advocates? I mean, were you going to represent the advocates today, Angela?
I'll be happy to represent my organization.
Okay, well, you're an advocate. And then I'll ask maybe someone from the lending industry, trying to get some of these issues between the 2 and 4 out, so members can have an understanding of that. Welcome.
Thank you. And let me start. Oh, for the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon. And I want to start by saying thank you for the work that was done during the work group. It was quite productive, taught me a lot about what we were looking at with the dash ones and how we have come very far forward with both the dash twos and the dash fours. We do offer our stronger support for the dash two amendments. The dash two amendments, as you learned, mirror the protections that are included in the law that was most recently passed in Minnesota. One of the things we learned while we were looking at the Dash 1 amendments during the work group was that this was originally a very strong bill, included some important core provisions that applied to loans that were really no longer being made. The Dash 1 amendments were based on a law that was passed in 2003, and since that time, lenders were making loans just below the thresholds that were set. And that really pulled out our concerns, or pulled out why we offer our strongest support for the Dash 2 amendments. It's based more on strong core principles that apply to all loans and allows for adjustments within a dynamic marketplace. I can guarantee, well, no one can guarantee, I can make a strong assumption that 4 years from now, the mortgages and refinance products that are available to lenders will look slightly different than they do today, again, because of changes in the marketplace. The Dash 2 amendments put some important consumer protections in place that will still be there as the products continue to change. The other benefit to the Dash 2 amendments I'd like to highlight is that it does offer protection on a homeowner's equity. Again, mentioned the provisions that prohibit loan flipping and limit prepayment penalties. These are two features that are often used to strip the equity from homeowners. Loan flipping is that process of moving homeowners into another loan, back-to-back refinances with no real net benefit to that homeowner. The money that they've built up in their home goes to the lender, not to the children for their college education. Prepayment penalties serve to lock lender or borrowers into loans that are no longer match their financial circumstances. So we see a real strong need to have some limits around these prepayment penalties. Those are the comments I'd like to offer and answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Just one thing, is one of those unusual things, but this is brought to my attention this morning, that this advertisement came in the fax machine of the Senate Majority Office today, and unsolicited, so this actually covers a couple of bills that we've kind of talked about, offering a 1.99% ARM, and then you kind of get the small print down here, you know, that can change at any moment, but kind of on some of those headline numbers that we're talking about here that look really good with an 888 number to come and get it. So anyway, alive and well. Thank you very much. Who from the lending industry would like to comment on the 2 or the 4? We'll be doing one of the 2, I will assure you. Drawing the short straw. Oh, it's even more courage now. Once Tim got up there, everybody had more courage.
We all follow our leader, Tim.
There you go. Welcome, Mr. Martinez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, joined by my colleagues from the lending community. We were part of the work group that you instructed to meet, and we did, as you've heard, meet several times. We did get the threes yesterday, the fours today, and I have not had any comment back on the fours. I think what Kate and how Janet described it are all accurate. The piece, though, that I would say that we're still struggling with, the guidelines idea was ours. We did bring these in. I think the committee needs to understand that guidelines for regulated depository lenders have been in place for at least a year. Those guidelines came out last year. The ones that we submitted to the work group were ones that have come out recently for basically the non-depository lenders. I think there is a huge difference between a depository lender and a non-depository. As part of the work group discussion, what became clear to me is if it's a guideline that's been issued to a bank or to a credit union for that matter, they take that as a rule. And they are examined to that level. And there are actions that DCBS or federal regulators can take for us not complying. When we raised that question at the work group about non-depository lenders, assuming the answer was going to be the same, we were told no. And I think Corey did indicate that the department has indeed adopted these guidelines, but they have no enforcement mechanism for those. They are just kind of best practices. And that's what we were looking for, was to try to find some language that would give them those enforcement abilities. Not necessarily, and it's proven in my brief conversation with Ken Sherman, our counsel on the Dash 3s, it has proven fairly difficult to try to figure out how the department would look at all these things if they were put in statute. So we do remain concerned about that. We do remain concerned about some of the civil penalties that are in the bill. We don't believe that there needs to be new penalties given, authority given to DCBS for this. We think they already have those. And I'd probably stop there and be happy to answer any questions. We have looked at the Dash 2. I get conflicting information. In fact, when we met at our weekly lenders, our financial institutions meeting today, some of us think the Minnesota bill has become law. Some of them think it's only passed one chamber. So we are trying to do some more research to see exactly where the Minnesota bill is. I'd be happy to answer any questions or wait till you're done with the rest of the panel.
Okay. Mr. Marquez, you just confused me on one issue you brought up.
Okay.
You brought about in your discussion with the department that you were looking at providing enforcement penalties for these guidelines, and then you, about a minute later, said, we don't think we need these enforcement penalties. They have the authority already, which they didn't have, which is why we started this. Would you clarify what
certainly,
you meant?
Certainly. And I, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. The department has clearly enforcement penalties that they can assess to banks, credit unions, and others under their existing law. My point I was making is we want to give them the ability to enforce those guidelines against non-depository lenders. We don't think that requires necessarily new penalties that are included in the Dash 4s that would also fall on banks and credit unions.
Okay, so you're saying the new penalties against the non-depository lenders, but that this is either repetitive or in addition to current penalties for your institutions.
Mr. Chairman, that's true, and I believe it's also in place for the non-depository lenders as well in general penalty statutes for them.
Mr. Markey?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Our association has membership from some of Tim's members in terms of mortgage departments and some of Pam's credit union members and some non-depository mortgage companies, so we sort of have a smattering of all. They are licensed under Chapter 59 and regulated by DCBS in terms of the non-depository types. And there are provision, regulatory provisions there for the department to regulate them and to take sanctions against them if they violate provisions of that licensing act. Our understanding sort of has always been, too, along with Tim, that there are provisions there for DCBS to go after somebody that violates any provision of the licensing act, and we thought these were going to be, these guidelines would become part of the licensing act for all of us, or at least either by rule or by statute, and that then they would continue with their enforcement power with respect to these just as the same as they would any other provision of the licensing act. So that's a kind of a long way of saying that I agree, I think, with what Tim said, that this special provision here where DCBS would be taking somebody to court and doing all that, I think is perhaps duplicative of some of the authority that they already have. So, frankly, we strongly favor the Dash 4s over the Dash 2s, I would say, and we think that these guidelines are just fine to have applicable to everyone. We're sort of having membership from all avenues here. We're sort of a group that likes everybody to play by the same rules, and I think that the Dash 4s kind of do that. So,
okay. Thank you. We got about 5 minutes. I'm going to lose my other members, so don't be repetitive, but add new material. That would be great.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, John McCulley representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. I can just echo what Jim and Tim have said concerning the bill, the issue of the Dash 4s, I think, are okay. It's the additional civil or the penalties provision that pile on to what already exists under Chapter 59, and that would be one of the main concerns. I would also add, and I don't think it's been mentioned yet, the findings that are contained in Section 3 of the bill. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they add anything. Those findings are subject to their own debate, and I'm not sure they need to even be a part of the legislation. It seems to kind of raise some emotions that don't need to be raised, at least on our part. So those would be the two comments I would have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Of course, I would prefer the Dash 2s that exempt credit unions. Credit unions and banks are subject to strict federal requirements on high-cost loan products. The Homeowner Equity Protection Act and Regulation Z, which is within Truth in Lending. All of our compliance officers and credit unions have to comply with these strict regulations. So that's the number one thing I heard from my members, is it's very difficult to comply with a federal law and a state law that overlap on top of each other. As a compliance officer sitting at a credit union trying to get a loan out, you want to make sure that the laws and the regulations are clear. And so that's what I'm concerned about. The Dash 4s are absolutely, you know, definitely better than Senate Bill 965, but I haven't had a chance to have our compliance folks go over how do these guidelines fit with what we have to comply with under National Credit Union Administration rules and guidelines. So I just wanted to express those.
Okay. Questions for any of our panelists? Okay, thank you. Does anybody else feel compelled at the moment to speak on this bill? Okay, then our final one I'm going to ask before we adjourn is ask DCBS come up one final time. I just want them to address the penalty discussion in terms of the overlay that has been suggested, and give me your feedback on that, and then we will carry this bill over till tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Corey Streisinger, Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with respect to the enforcement issues, each of the types of financial institutions that we regulate, there are enforcement provisions in the licensing statute for that type of institution. And we can see several ways that you could address the enforcement issues here. This statute, because it applies across the board, won't be placed in any one of those existing chapters. So one way to address it is to have it have its own enforcement and penalty provisions, although, as I mentioned earlier, we think they should be aligned with the more standard types of enforcement and penalty provisions that we have in the licensing statutes. The other way to do it would be, rather than to have separate licensing or separate penalty and enforcement provisions in this bill, to simply add a reference to this new bill to the enforcement provisions in each of the licensing statutes so that it says, for example, consumer finance of it deals with violations of Chapter 725. It could say violations of Chapter 725 or this new bill. So there are a number of ways to do it. I don't think anybody's interested in having duplicate or overlapping enforcement mechanisms.
Okay. Does that clarify any of that? It does for me, but I want to see it from members. What we're going to do is we're going to move this bill tomorrow, and either the dash 2 or the dash 4, my inclination right now, from what I hear, the dash 4 is more comprehensive in terms of the work that has gone into both on a federal level and national level, but I'm still open to that. What I would like to do is ask Ms. Streisinger if you could work with Janet, preferably right after the meeting, but you know, very quickly, and maybe with some of the lending folks to see if we can reach some resolution in terms of what you just talked about in terms of reference to existing, you know, enforcement penalties, if there's another type of language approach you would want to take that would bring a greater comfort level, that would still give us time to do that here. If that doesn't exist, thank you, Senator Deckert. If that doesn't exist, then we could go with it the way it is. And I do want folks to know is that, first of all, Kate Newhall and Jim Olasky and others and a lot of people who are in the room here have worked really, really hard on this. And I know you've spent a lot of hours. I know the hours you've worked on this in a very positive way, I might say. And I really appreciate that. Trying to protect consumers, also trying to have a healthy industry. Obviously, those are concerns for all of us. And I really appreciate the efforts on that. And I realize that as we move over to the House, that there will be this discussion isn't going to end. I don't intend for that to end. We do have some arbitrary deadlines in order to keep legislation moving. If we have a general consensus that it's you know in the right area, even if it may not be totally ripe in some of the issues, but I would like to resolve some of those for tomorrow, if at all possible, and then continue that discussion as we move through the House. If we can clarify anything else around the edges to make it even better. We're going to continue to do that. I don't look at it as a final product necessarily. So, any questions before we adjourn for the day?
We're not moving this bill.
We're not going to move it today. We're going to move it tomorrow, Senator.
Okay.
We had a couple questions I think we can still resolve prior to moving it forward. Tomorrow will be, we're meeting at 1 o'clock. I think we're back in our regular room. Monday is our last committee meeting on Senate bills. So we will get things in the process. And we'll then be diligently working on our House bills. The only member that really gets a reprieve from this, you see, is Senator Deckert, because being the great one that he is, he has this ultimate authority to keep his revenue committee without the same deadlines that the rest of us have to adhere to. So, you know, we're envious, Senator, of that. I'm going to close public hearing 965. We're adjourned. Thank you.